Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung.
How many construction workers are there in India? It's 60 million.
Constructing in order to continue history and existing buildings is an interplay of challenges and opportunities. One strategy is to persist in a museum-like preservation of the past. Another strategy, although, is to courageously continue building with history. The roots of Studio Lotus lie in learning history and local environment. They follow an iterative and incremental methodology of innovation. Studio Lotus takes a deep contextual approach to its work and combines this with a strong focus on tactile and sensory qualities of space. Their design process looks at sustainability through multiple lenses of cultural, social, and environmental impacts. There's an active engagement in integrating local skills and resources with state-of-the-art materials and technologies. We, Katrina and Diane from Jung, talked to Ambrish Arora from Studio Lotus in New Delhi, India, about this approach and its challenges.
Studio Lotus is a multidisciplinary, award-winning practice and one of India's leading architecture and interior design firms. They believe in delivering enriching design solutions through a value-driven process empowering all stakeholders as well as the environment. The studio is based in New Delhi and was founded in 2002 by yourself, Ambrish, together with Ankur Shoksi and Siddhartha Talwar. A very warm welcome to you to the Jung Architecture Talks, and it's great to have you with us today, Ambrish.
Thank you, Diane and Catherine. I look forward to our conversation.
The ethnic and religious history of the Indian subcontinent is reflected in many places by impressive buildings and complexes. 3,000 years of time layers shape the context in which you design and build. How do you embrace this heritage and what strategy do you apply in order to continue building history?
To begin with, I think it's as intimidating for us as it is for any visitor to try and even pretend that we understand or know enough about the context we live in. I think one thing I am consciously aware of and we are collectively aware of as a studio is that our knowledge of our historical context is very limited. India as a country is not really one country and depends what lens you hold up. But if you begin even with a simple lens of agroclimatic regions, we have over 52 agroclimatic regions. We have over 200 languages. If you look at the architectural expression across the length and breadth of the country, it's mind-boggling. Probably Stuttgart and New Delhi have more in common than Kerala and Ladakh, the two regions of the country. So the first step is just the recognition of the complexity of these cultures across the length and breadth of the country. And I think one way of doing that is to put aside the political idea of India, and begin to really accept and acknowledge the regional, the cultural, the social, and climatic and ecological diversity as one would do across a multitude of cultures. So we kind of begin there. And then that allows us to take a much more focused view of the context we are building in. So I think as a practitioner, one of the first things I would do is, depending on where one is building, one really begins to immerse oneself into the context of that particular region, or in some cases, the micro region, because there are nuances that begin to kind of emerge even within a state like Rajasthan. Like if I were to look at a city like Jodhpur, the influences of Jodhpur would be very different from, say, a Jaisalmer, which is right out in the desert, right? And just even those kind of nuances begin to inform the process that one adopts. So, yeah, I mean, that's where I think we begin.
Yeah, the city of Jodhpur is also called the blue city, right? And compared to Jaipur is the pink city, kind of.
So, and Jaisalmer is the golden city, it's the yellow city.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's quite, and it comes from the color of the stone. So Jaisalmer has this yellow stone that comes from there, and the city was built with that stone. And Jaipur has the blue city, is called the blue city because of the blue lime wash that's used to paint a large part of the inner city. And Jaipur had this pink lime plaster that was used extensively, so that kind of gave rise to the pink city. So, yeah, I mean, there were these, I think, organic kind of expressions that began to emerge and began to give an identity to that region.
Yeah, and everything looks like it has been a part of it for a long time or always, because it's like carved of stone. And I've been to Varanasi, and when I looked at pictures of Jodhpur, it made me think a bit of Varanasi with all the small streets where you don't really know where they take you. And it's kind of surprise, but also a big part of the whole environment.
Yeah. So, you know, that's what's also interesting. So while we have these differences, but there are certain factors that are common. So, for instance, if you were to go into any of the old cities, say go into, like you said, the walled city of Jodhpur or Varanasi or even Delhi, you begin to experience the coexistence of a lot of diversity because the cities became like this melting pot of this immense diversity, right? So you had people of different cultures, different religions, even within one religion, you got hundreds of castes, right? And these castes are not necessarily the upper and the lower, but even within one, they're just different people who believe in different things. They have different diets, that there's a whole caste that doesn't have onions and garlic. You had these little clusters, mini clusters within every city. So if you went to Calcutta and you went into Bombay and you went to Delhi and even say the smaller towns, you would have little pockets of mini cultures within that, which kind of intensely woven together into the fabric of these cities. And the cities were almost constructed to be these very dense neighborhoods. You know, the buildings are built in a way that they're self-shading. They're very pedestrian. Kind of everything is walkable. There is an intensity and density. And this idea of community is very, very strong. So there is the micro community, and then there's that kind of intermingling of communities around which these old urban fabrics kind of came up around. So yes, on one hand, you have this tremendous kind of difference, disparity and diversity. On the other hand, you have this intermingling of all these cultures in these dense pockets. It's quite magical as you walk through these little towns, as you must have experienced. When
yes,
you were
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And one of the studio's milestones, Ambrish, is actually a hotel project in Jodhpur. Tell us why this project is so special and how it influences the further work of your office.
I mean, we were very, very fortunate to have gotten this project in the first place. We had never really done a building. We'd got a few interior projects in our portfolio until that time. And we'd done a little project in the fort in the city, the old Mehrangarh fort, which is a 15th century fort within the walled city of Jodhpur. And we had done a small shop there, which was an adaptive reuse project. And the reason we'd gotten that project was because they had no budget and they had no fees to pay a proper architect. So they said, okay, let's just get some young kids from Delhi. And, you know, they knew someone, we knew someone. And it was a huge, huge learning for us as a studio. We ended up discovering so much about the way these forts were built. The little shop was a process of discovery, both intellectually and physically. So the approach we took was to unravel the layers within the fort. So the conventional approach towards restoration, largely until that time, was one of recreating the olden structures were. So if you looked at the way the kings built, the idea was to layer the construction material with a beautiful kind of facade. So they would kind of plaster it with lime, they would decorate it. And over a period of time, as these layers peeled off, each time they would be restored, they would be restored with less precision and less kind of fine work because it costs that much more and access to that skill was not available. So we kind of reversed the thing on its head and we stripped off all the layers of decoration in this one section of the fort to reveal how it was constructed and the mass. So there were these walls which were 3 meters kind of thick and, you know, 4 meters thick of stone, of solid stone. And you kind of walk into this almost cave-like experience and you begin to get a sense of the structure. And within that, we placed very light metal framework for the shelving and kind of let people experience the construction of this fantastic structure. I think it was very, very inexpensive to do because it was almost like the first step towards restoration, but we left it there. So we stripped it and just left it in one section of the fort. So you went through the fort and then you came to this one almost, I mean, it wasn't a grotto, but it gave you that feeling. You began to discover the skeleton of this structure. So the family who was from Jodhpur, in fact, at that time, the gentleman who was the CEO of the trust, absolutely, we worked collaboratively with him and he loved the outcome. And his sons were in the travel trade and they all are from Jodhpur. They absolutely love the city. And the sons are well-traveled. They studied abroad. They'd come back and settle into the city. And they were very familiar with what luxury travel meant for international travelers. And they wanted to move away from the cliche of this Maharaja kind of experience and do something authentic and do it in the old city and do it very simply. So they really loved the approach we'd taken for this little shop. And based on that, we got the commission to do the hotel. And before that, we were just in the process of building our first house. So it was very intimidating for us. So
from a house to a fortress.
Yeah, I mean, to do this hotel and in this little dense part of the city, I think that is what also pushed us a lot to do justice to what did heritage mean and what is it about heritage that was important and why were we doing this project? What's the narrative we want people to know about? It was a process of self-discovery as much as, it's like when you're writing a book or an essay, you're also discovering your own thought process. And we were in the process of forming that and discovering for ourselves, and as was our client. So it was really a very, very, very collaborative project. We were sitting together saying, why are we doing this? What is it that's important? What's the approach we want to take? And I think one thing that became clear and which we agreed upon was the definition of heritage. And the definition of heritage that we felt was relevant for our country was the idea of living heritage, because there is so much built heritage around us. Like, you know, even in Delhi, I walk out of my studio, I walk down, I have like hundreds of 15th, 16th century monuments. Somebody's got a little like shop inside it. Somebody's using it as a garbage dump. You've got like this continuum of structures which are old and then somebody's built something on it, because you can't preserve all of it, right? There's not enough built space. People need space to live and all that. So it's all, one wall is built yesterday and one wall touching it might be, I don't know, 300 years old. So we've grown up with this idea of historic structures really being part of a living space. But what is really we were losing and which we felt needed to be addressed and built upon is this idea of the artisanal craft that the generations of people, say the stone workers, the lime workers, even simple carpenters, whole generations of these artisans, and how they had kind of stopped practicing this skill and moved towards a so-called modern, their aspiration was the kids to have a modern education. And after that education, get a degree, and after that, get a job behind a desk or not. I mean, now there are so many graduates in India that a lot of them are just peons or clerks or security guards. But this idea of the white collar being more important than the blue collar, because there was no value left for the skill. And a part of the reason was that it had never been seriously reinvented. Like, how does it become aspirational? How does it become relevant to today? And not just as a nostalgic kind of response, saying, oh, we are losing this, it's very sad, but can it truly add value in a way that's relevant to today's narrative? And we felt therein lay the opportunity of defining how we will look at luxury. So all of India, I would say the majority of India, was moving towards building their architectural aspirations through expensive materials, through precision, through more and more use of machines, importing equipment, going this lure of high tech, of the gloss, etc. And we saw there a big opportunity for luxury getting defined by craft and craftsmanship, but in a form that's a lot more contemporary and kind of creating that benchmark for people to look up to and say, okay, look, this is another way we can look at luxury and we can aspire to have it in our lives. So if you look at the project, the parameters we started to define was more the process than the outcome. So to give you one example, so we were doing these kind of lattice walls, which is a traditional Indian method of passive cooling and ventilation, where you use these jalis, they're called jalis, they're lattice kind of screens, which shade spaces and they allow spaces to be ventilated and give privacy. So we were very initially driven by form, and we started referring to traditional form and kind of doing a modern take on the traditional form. And when we started going into construction, we found that because we were working with very tight budgets, that the cheaper way to do it would be to just cut it on a water jet machine and not by hand and get the form beautifully and do a more, say, modern form, modern expression. But somewhere we collectively felt that that was going away from the philosophy of why we were doing this, right? So while it would have looked like a beautiful sandstone building with beautiful graphic forms that are very modern, the process is not authentic. So we actually went back to the drawing board and we said, look, if we were to do it by hand, then what is the most efficient way of doing a much simpler form, which was done by hand and in the process was not so precise, right? And then we approached it in a different way and we sat down with the artisans and said, look, this is our budget and this is your cost. And how can we do a form that you can do in so many days? And what kind of form can you do in so many days? So they did this really simple kind of linear expressions, which we then made a composition of on site. And we created a building that was entirely handmade, but the form itself was completely, I would say, very graphic, very contemporary, but had nothing to do with the traditional form, right? But the material was entirely regional from within 20 kilometers of the site. The people who were working on it were entirely from that region. And the process we used was entirely by hand. So for us, our decision-making matrix was not determined by, I would say, the vision of the architect, really, but more the value system of this collaboration that we wanted to work with. That was a huge learning, you know, and we began to see that, look, if we begin to focus on the process, it was quite strange. So when we started this project, we had an elevation drawn up. In fact, we had some 10 iterations drawn up. And then we started work. And then midway through the project, we entirely changed the elevation of the building. It sounds crazy, right, for a project of this scale, of this nature, that you change the elevation after you finish the structure, right? But we realized that, you know, it's really like the human being, right? It's the most important thing is the soul, and then maybe our skeleton, and then maybe our muscles and flesh, and then the clothes, which is what the facade is, really, you can allow it to form. And that was something we have become increasingly comfortable with as a process. In fact, the next project with this client, we consciously stayed away from defining the facade, and it was a reasonably big hotel project in the mountains, in the Himalayas, in a totally different context, climatically, culturally, and geographically. And we used this idea of a framework where the program and the site and the larger morphology of the building got defined through a combination of the climate, the guest experience, the actual service experience, which are fundamental, say, to a hotel. And then perhaps more a formal experience that emerged from the context of the site. It was on a sloping hill. It needed to respond to the flow of water, how water would flow through the building, ecological response, which was climatic positioning, and a response to the views. The actual expression of the building and what it would look like was something that we created a framework for, but we chose not to close that out completely. Because we both knew that that was something that would emerge from our exploration of what we had available to us there, which we did not know enough about. I'm post-rationalizing as I speak. I think it's also this recognition that you don't know enough to decide everything up front, that as an individual, as a studio, our knowledge is very, very limited in terms of the context of where we are going to work. So no matter how much research you do, but when you actually start building and there is an intention, then when the person who begins to build comes on the site, he brings also a whole layer of knowledge and wisdom, which you don't have. And what we also begin to probe, for instance, in this project was, we are also very conscious of, like, how do you decide between one material or another material? Our initial idea was to use this stone, which was, again, from the region, but was used for the homes of the wealthier people in the community. And we thought that is what we will use. And then while working on it, we discovered this stone that is wasted in the quarries and thrown. And actually, all the poorer structures and the structures in the field are made from that. And we said, look, why can't this be the material for doing the hotel, which is a luxury hotel? It might even be, I don't know, $500 a night. But if we start to use a material like that, not only from a sustainability perspective, it's great. It's also the story it begins to tell, that no material really is poor. It's what you do with it, how you build with it. So there was this kind of evolving process of decision making, which came from the premise that we did not know enough until the people who were working on the building came to site to work on it. And their skills and how they work with the material will help us decide what's the best response. So there is an intention. There is almost like this cloud. You're seeing the project through a filter, which is hazy. But you then allow all the other forces, all the other people working on it, to begin to shape this cloud. And the process becomes much more emergent and much more evolutionary and much richer, right? And also, I think what it also does, it builds a tremendous sense of ownership for the person who's working on the ground. So that person's role is not to translate the vision of this genius kind of one architect who wants everything done exactly like this, and then the whole world is coming together to deliver that solution, right? That's what we are taught, right? Like, you've got this genius and he's conceptualized something, and then what material, what can the engineer do? What can the contractor do to make that genius kind of idea come to life? Whereas you step back and you say, okay, this is what we need to fulfill. And what can you bring to the project that I will change my idea, right? So I should be willing to not hold on to something because I think that's the way I want it, but allow it to be informed by something which is far more rich. And somewhere I think it also begins to embody the collective vision of a group of people who in some way are vested in the outcome, and then they put their best. So I feel in order to harness this human energy, at last count, I just before the talk, I did a research of how many construction workers are there in India, and it's 60 million.
Oh, wow.
There are 60 million people in the construction industry in this country. And over the last 20 years or 30 years, I think we've caused more damage to this population, because what is happening with this idea, which is, I would say, largely imported, of precision, of so-called modern materials, modern skills, the human being is becoming more and more dispensable. And this construction worker is actually moving more and more down the value chain, because his skill is actually not required anymore because a machine is giving more precision. But the kind of skill he has actually can give the building and the project a much richer expression and a richer experience. And it can often give something that no machine can ever give, because as you are building, something is getting expressed, which only a human mind and human energy can bring. And that gap is something that I think is very dangerous to ignore. If we are always kind of playing with this idea of efficiency and measuring efficiency by output and precision, then for a country like ours, it's a measure that's, I think, potentially disastrous.
We've been talking in our first conversation we had, you were saying, like, embracing the past, but you do not only mean the history of context. You also refer, as you explained it very well, to the process of the decisions remaining, like, visible within the building. Let's move to another project, which was very interesting, as it's just a government building, the Krushi Bhavan project. which is a further development of this idea on a different scale. So how was it possible to convince like the clients to go that way and not stay in this, as you just explained it, very modern, precise, very detailed building?
Like with less technology, right? That's what you're referring to.
Yeah. So this building kind of questioned the norm at various levels. So let me start with the non-visual part, which a lot of people don't see. The first idea we began to question was this idea of comfort. What is comfortable for a person climatically in terms of when do I feel hot and when do I feel cold, right? So again, this idea of a universal measure of comfort, which is what the international sustainability parameters, like companies like LEED do, okay, 26 degrees at, 50% humidity, that's comfortable, right? Who says it's comfortable? Actually, it doesn't make any sense.
For us, it's not that comfortable.
Yeah, no. But
no, I had the feeling it was like 98% humidity in India, and 26 degrees would not make it better.
Yeah, but you know, Catherine, gets really interesting. So you were designing this government building for people who live in that city, who've grown up in that city, who've grown up at 38 degrees with 90% humidity, right? They don't need 26 or 50% to feel comfortable, right? Because what you don't realize is that the carbon footprint required to create that differential, we don't have that kind of energy in this country for over a billion people. I mean, it's just crazy to have even as an aspiration. And if you see the benchmarks, they're there to see. So if you go to the old government buildings, which were built, say, in the 60s, 70s, some of them are not that well designed, but still they function pretty well. So there are people sitting in offices that are not air-conditioned, and they've covered the windows with storage cabinets to shade the glare, and they've got fans, and there's not much ventilation because no one really thought of it that much. And the windows were made, but somebody opens them, somebody doesn't. But they're actually been working like that for 10 years. And if you're creating a new facility, you actually have the opportunity of making that like 50% better. So there's this idea of adaptive thermal comfort. So when you wear the kind of clothes that that environment in that context you need to wear, which is we have hand looms, we have very thin cotton, they're very porous, they're light clothes, they're kind of often half sleeves. And that's what the traditional attire of people would be, the kind of food we eat. So they would eat a lot of rice, a lot of curd, a lot of coconut, things that kind of help your body perspire. And then you have some breeze. And then in the shade, if you're able to achieve a 7 to 8 degree difference, you feel very comfortable. So even if it's 38 degrees outside and you're able to achieve 30 degrees, 29 degrees in the shade and you have some breeze, you feel super comfortable. And your energy footprint to design a building of that nature, as compared to an air-conditioned sealed building with double glazing and high UVs and all the stuff that comes with technology, your cost, your embodied energy cost comes down, to 1/3. Your operating energy comes down to 1/5. But your measure needs to be different. Your measure needs to be of this idea of adaptive thermal comfort. Whereas if I go to Kashmir or Ladakh, where people are used to living in minus 15 degrees in these mud homes, for them, you know, even 20 degrees is warm, right? So for them, comfortable is to be 15 because they're dressed like that. They've got woolen things, they've got insulated walls. So we need to, or I would say the entire cross-section of developing nations whose access to energy is limited. All our energy comes from fossil fuels at the moment. We don't have enough alternative kind of sources of energy. Mm-hmm. We have to set regional parameters that are sensible for that region. So we were very fortunate. We were invited by the government. The chief minister in this case was a very enlightened person. And usually the government process ends up selecting the cheapest architects. But he invited 4 or 5 architects from across the country to do what would become benchmark projects for the city. And he said, what's a new way of looking at a government building? And he had asked us to do this building. And agriculture is a very important part of Odisha, the states. In fact, it's the only state that's called the agricultural state. It's a big part of their USP of what they portray themselves as. And we started by proposing that we create a measure, or we work with a measure that's more contextual, and we do a building that's 80% passively cooled. And that was met with a huge resistance initially from the bureaucracy, saying they wanted, why should we get a non-air-conditioned building? Everyone's getting air-conditioned buildings. And we felt it was the responsibility of the government to show the way to do this, right? So a lot of natural ventilation, a lot of systems to passively cool the entire building. And we succeeded in getting a building that's 80% of the building is naturally passively cooled. And it's been very effective and very successful. So this was on the sustainability, and I won't get into too much detail. I mean, there was a lot of shading kind of details, air circulation details, solar chimneys, insulated walls, so on, wall-window ratios, all of that. What was really remarkable was that they were willing to give it a shot. And the second bit was the identity of the building, right? And again, this idea of what's modern. In India, it's a very big thing. We look at Dubai, we look at Singapore, we look at China, and we say, this is all modern. And we actually wanted to redefine what modern means in our context. And each region should have its own definition. And that's what we try and do. And really, modern is the way we live, our lifestyle, the way we have access to light, air, technology, water, healthcare, and the way we sit has changed. So a large part of India used to sit on the floor. Now we sit on tables and chairs, right? So that's modern. Things like that, right? And the idea of comfort kind of moving up by a level, right? Access to comfort for everyone. So after that, we said, what is it? So this idea of living heritage came into play. And traditionally, the royal families used to be patrons of the crafts. And that's why the crafts thrived. So from stone carving to metal casting to woodworking, they were all under the patronage of the king. So the palaces and the rich people's homes were patrons for the craft. But now there are no kings, and the rich people want to build homes like in Dubai. So then who's going to patronize this, right? So it's the role of the government to begin to patronize these craftsmen. But also, we felt it was an opportunity to do something that was not just showcase the craft, but gave the craft a new lease of life so that it becomes aspirational for this big bunch of hospitality brands, you know, high net worth individuals. So how do you create something that's sexy using a skill that's traditional? So, and again, we realized we don't have all the skills. We don't have the understanding. So we got a collaborator in the form of a local architect who'd been working with craft. And we designed a building where the entire ground floor of the building became a public space. And we lifted the offices up. And the entire building was clad with a local stone or laterite stone, which is a relatively soft stone. And there was a lot of opportunities to create free-flowing spaces using all these techniques. So screens, because there was a lot of porosity. And all these walls became storytelling walls, borrowing from local mythology, storytelling around agriculture, the agricultural seasons, and so on and so forth. And we allowed for this canvas to be populated by this architect working in collaboration with the artisans. And so there was this massive wall, which is part of the building facade, which is, I think, about 30 meters by 10 meters, 40 meters by 10 meters. And we did this wall in laterite, and then the artisans came and carved on it. And the way it went was the Sibanand, this collaborator of ours, came and sketched on it with a chalk. And then we had these artisans kind of carve on the building. So it was like the way temples were made, but it was a modern temple, and they weren't carving figures of gods and goddesses, but they were carving very graphic patterns of crops and plants and trees, you know, and they were so excited because they had not done this work ever. And for 6 months, the whole building, the process of making the building became like a museum for the cities. So visitors would come and see the work happening. So not the end product, but this act of creating the building became like, even for us as a studio, it became a process of discovery. We would go back and we would see something we did not expect and we had not agreed upon or signed off on things. And very often, they just decided to do something and you had to step back and say, okay, that's fine, you know. And it's all these filters we have, right, of what's beautiful, what's not beautiful.
At the same time, you have to be willing to let go. And sometimes things don't all match, right? And things don't need to match, right? So there is also this whole kind of process of self-discovery and letting go of how I think things should be. Because if the intention is there and the skills are there, so you make sure, what you need to make sure is that the people working are very skilled. But then you allow for the symphony to happen and you're only facilitating the process.
So on the one hand, you're actually saying use the hand to build. And on the other hand, you're actually talking about technology versus common sense. And as we hear you speaking, actually, your aim is to develop solutions that set standards, right, for sustainable design. And to achieve this goal, you strongly take the society's change of living and working into account, of course. What we also heard is India is actually experiencing a major transformation, what you were telling us right now. And a large part of the country is rural. So while cities with millions of inhabitants are growing with increasing prosperity, is this like a fine line between striving for more and a sustainable use of limited resources?
So, Catherine, I don't know. I think it's so chaotic, right? I mean, in this country, I mean, it's so unplanned. So I've not tried to look at, are we making a big difference? But I know what has happened. I know that in this little project we did in Bhubaneswar in Odisha, it has shown a way to this massive, like the government is one of the biggest patrons of construction in the country, right? To show there is a way of just building beautifully in a much more responsible and inclusive manner, where you are focusing not just on the image you're creating. Unfortunately, that's all that it's become about, is what's the image of what you're creating. And we needed to make sure that that image is also fulfilled. And we did it through that pattern of the weave, which is derived from the local tradition of textile. But to me, that's not even a fraction of the true story of the building and what it tries to do. But this idea of urbanization being, could it be more inclusive? Because a lot of that urbanization is being kind of driven by migration. Like it's everywhere, all over the world. And it's just that I would imagine the disparity of the people who are moving in here in countries like ours is much, much more. And we see it, right? I mean, the standards of comfort are just, I mean, it's crazy. So can we begin to question standards and set more responsible standards which allow a more responsible distribution of that limited resource of energy that we have and material that we have? So I think that's what we are looking at. Unfortunately for us, because the nature of our studio, most of our clients are rich people or rich institutions or rich hotels. And we try and tread that fine line of, can we redefine luxury? Like, what is luxury? And it's not an easy one. But yeah, I think, so while we are privileged to work on public projects where it's a little easier, but even in these so-called luxury projects, and you work in hospitality, right? You're kind of setting aspirational spaces. Can you change aspirations? It's an experiment. I don't know. I don't think we've succeeded or anything, but I think it's a constant ongoing experiment for us as a studio to survive as well and keep getting work, because we don't want clients to think we're crazy and saying we're here to run a business and not social change, right? So we are trying to create that as a design differentiator. So you need to work twice as hard, but I think it's totally worth it because you can bridge these worlds. At least you have an opportunity to begin to bridge these worlds.
We also heard you say that today's architect must be the facilitator rather than being an author. What does that mean to you?
Personally?
Yeah, of course.
No, as a studio or as a studio.
Both, if there are any differences.
Well, there is a difference. So my personal goal is to disappear and not have an identity. And really, like, if in a conversation, if I can be so present to everything around me that none of my filters and prejudices are present, so that I'm so present that the project gets just formed on its own and I don't need to do anything. I just hold this cloud of, hopefully, of a set of values and just hold it up as a measure saying, okay, are we achieving what we set out to do? And it's very difficult because I have an artistic aspiration as well. And it does creep in from behind like that. And, oh, this doesn't look nice. And then, you know, that's, it's a difficult one, but
yes, I hope to keep moving on that journey and step back and allow, even within the studio, that's a big part of what I do, is make people aware that when you start a project, do not start a sentence ever saying, I like this or I want this. It's a very easy one to get lost in, because then everyone else shuts up. What I really mean by this idea of a facilitator is, I think the planet today has enough building. We don't need one more wow building. I think it's just crazy, this aspiration of being driven by that we have one more artist, you know, and architects today don't need to be artists. I think we need to serve and be a bridge to what we are doing to the planet. Construction is the single most damaging thing to the planet. I mean, no question. And unless we are able to step back and allow, in the lightest way possible, to integrate all these various things that are at play, from the climate to the resources to the people who are building and all the factors at play, we will not be able to harness all the energies that potentially could yield very, very rich and diverse solutions, because we'll be so caught up with our own signature at the bottom of the painting that we will not see everything else. I don't know, it's a perfect analogy, but it's a bit like jazz. You know, you have to allow the musicians to play their own instrument. You discover something new all the time. So even if we are to continue our journey of learning, then unless we allow each musician to play their own instrument in their own way, in this larger kind of musical piece, there will be no process of discovery or something new. Yeah, that's what I mean by this idea of a facilitator.
It's so great to see how sensitive, how sensual, how respectful you are working. I think the craftsmen can be very happy to have an architect to work with like you are, or your studio is. Maybe we should keep that in mind, to respect their work a little bit each day, because they're so important for us, to respect their knowledge and their experience beside to the ideas we have.
Yeah, you know, Dan, I mean, to be honest, a lot of what I spoke about is our ideal. And on a scale of 10, I would say we are at a 5, you know. So how much we are able to translate of this idea, it varies project to project. We get caught up with the everyday kind of issues of survival, deadlines, budgets, projects. But I think at the same time, one of the things also is, what one is also trying to do is not limit this conversation. So as we scale up, that's one of the things we're trying to do, is can you scale up this idea? It's not about a boutique studio doing this kind of experimental work, but can we allow this thinking to percolate in any context? Even on a scale of 10, if you're at a 3 or a 4, it's better than 0, right? So I think the idea is to just keep every day, go in and do your best, and then be okay with the failures, right? And then try again. And I think I still consider ourselves a struggling studio, because we're struggling to keep our values alive and keep our lens focused, because it's very easy to get carried away. And I think I'm really thankful to you that conversations like these also become a mirror to hold up, because I realize we all lose the way in this crazy, crazy world. I'm really, really grateful, Catherine, to you and Deanne, for giving me an opportunity to hold up that mirror. Also bring alive for myself why we are doing what we're doing. And thank you.
Thanks to you. We were very impressed. If our listeners could see our faces, that we are so happy and we could just go on listening and smiling all the time. So we send you a lot of greetings to New Delhi. And it was a great, great, great pleasure talking and listening to you.
And I hope to host you when you're in Delhi.
Oh, we'd love to.
I have a new house, and our most favorite part of the house is a guest room, because we hope to have guests from all over and host them and have them live with us. I have made some of my greatest friends like that. Have to be recorded. I remember there was this one architect who wrote to me, a Japanese architect on Facebook, saying, what building should I visit? So I said, why don't you come home? And then he landed from the airport, he checked into a hotel, he came home, and I said, why don't you go get your bag And he got his bag, and then he stayed for 3 weeks in the house. So, and we became really like the best of friends. So, but now, and that time we didn't even have a guest room. So he was on a mattress on the floor in one room. But really, yeah, that's really a, truly an invitation. So, yeah.
Thank you very much. We're going to take that pretty seriously. Yeah. And for today, namaste and take care.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Thank you so much.
Many thanks to our listeners as well. We're looking forward to share our upcoming Jung Architecture Talks podcast with all of you. Tune in on jung.de/podcasts.